last speaker interviewed for this program is Dr. Nair Rizvi, who began our conversation by discussing some interesting research he's been involved with at Memorial, namely translational trials on preoperative therapy.
We've been doing work with incorporating Avastin as part of our neoadjuvant and adjuvant treatment for patients who have locally advanced lung cancer. We've also done some work incorporating Tarceva for patients who are never smokers or minimal smokers and as part of our neoadjuvant strategy. I think that neoadjuvant treatment is not completely accepted in this country in terms of usage, but I think that there are a number of reasons why it poses some advantages over adjuvant chemotherapy. The first being that you can see if you're treatment works, and you can see if you're hitting your target and shrinking the tumor and doing your job, and if you are, then great, and if you're not, you can move on. The other reason is that it is very hard to deliver chemotherapy after a big operation, and across the board, the compliance to chemotherapy is in the 60 to 70% drug delivery range adjuvantly, whereas it's probably closer to 80, 90% preoperatively. So I think we do a better job of getting the drugs in preoperatively, which is really our goal, and it doesn't compromise the surgery. So there's pros to giving preoperative chemotherapy. I think that in terms of trials, I alluded to the use of Avastin. Certainly, Avastin has been reasonably well accepted in terms of stage 4 patients based on data showing a survival benefit with chemotherapy plus Avastin over chemotherapy alone. And we've been running a trial for the last really couple of years now, giving Avastin with chemotherapy as part of our preoperative treatment strategy and then continuing them on adjuvant therapy afterwards for stage 1B to 3A non-small cell lung cancer patients. That's non-squamous tumors. And as you know, there is an intergroup trial really assessing the role for Avastin in adjuvant patients who have had resected lung cancer, and that's ongoing nationwide to look at chemotherapy plus or minus Avastin for patients who have had resected lung cancer.
I wanted to sort of pick up on the pre-op thing, because it seems like there are not too many places that are actually looking at that, and there are a couple angles. One is the issue of being able to look at the tissue before and after, the translational aspect, but the other is the clinical aspect, which it seems like hasn't really been fully accepted, but outside of a protocol setting where maybe you want to look at the tissue, but just for clinical purposes, what are the kinds of situations where you might consider pre-op therapy?
Probably, you know, important message would be to, when you see these patients who are sent by whomever, I think it's important to think about why they're there. And sometimes when the surgeon sends a patient for preoperative chemotherapy, the patient has a big tumor and has multiple nodal stations involved. I mean, frankly, that sort of a patient is not really a surgical candidate, and I think that those patients who are going to need a pneumonectomy who've got multiple nodes involved are really best served by giving definitive chemotherapy and radiation therapy. So I think it's a mistake to be trying to resect patients who really are technically unresectable when they hit your door as a medical oncologist, because if they're unresectable before chemotherapy, they're not miraculously going to be resectable and cured by surgery after chemotherapy. So although there may be some shrinkage, there typically does remain a lot of disease left behind. So, and then you end up compromising their definitive therapy, which is chemotherapy and radiation. The intergroup trial that was done comparing chemotherapy radiation versus chemotherapy radiation and surgery. So chemotherapy and radiation is given preoperatively followed by an operation versus chemo and radiation alone. In terms of the overall results, there was really no survival benefit by adding surgery to the treatment. And I think that that's really important data. The other piece of that study was that in an unplanned subset analysis, those patients who their surgery was a lobectomy, they actually did seem to have a survival benefit, whereas those patients who underwent a pneumonectomy didn't. So I think, again, that speaks to the candidacy of a patient for an operation from the get-go. If the patient's going to need a pneumonectomy or a big operation, they're probably not going to be served well by an operation.
So if you happen to see a patient who gets referred with earlier stage disease, or if you're talking to your thoracic surgeon in your tumor board conference and they say, well, can you defend the idea of using preoperative therapy in a patient like that, how would you respond?
I think that for patients who are resectable and who have limited nodal station disease that are good surgical candidates, I think that it's important to look at the data for 3A disease and the long-term survival. And I think that every way that you can optimize their long-term survival, it's important. I think that chemotherapy does. I think you can see if your chemotherapy works. I think you're right. There are certain negatives, such as you don't have all the molecular data, perhaps, preoperatively, but I think you have the most important data, which is the in vivo assessment of treatment benefit. So you see if your treatments work. You can treat micrometastases or distant metastases from the very early start. And I think that there are definitely pros in terms of drug delivery for these patients.
Obviously, in breast cancer, it's a very much more commonly explored issue. And there, of course, again, the translational issues come to bear. What exactly are you looking at? What kind of chemo with the Bev are you using in your study?
For induction therapy, we have two trials. One is for patients who are less likely to have EGFR mutations, so those patients who maybe have more significant smoking history, and where those patients were giving docetaxel, cisplatin with bevacizumab as our induction treatment. And then we have another trial for patients who are less than 15 pack year smokers. Again, both these studies are for patients who have 1B to 3A disease, and we're giving in that study, because of their minimal smoking history, we want to incorporate Tarceva into our treatment approach, and we're giving them Tarceva, and our chemotherapy choice for that induction trial is pemetrexed and cisplatin.
And then you're giving Bev on top of that, or just Tarceva?
No, that's just for the never minimal smokers. We're just giving the Tarceva.
Now, are you, in these patients going on the preoperative trials, are you able to get, for example, EGFR mutation studies done preoperatively on the biopsy?
We often, for patients who are on these preoperative trials, it's hard to do that because often there isn't sufficient material, or by the time we get it from an outside hospital and we get it analyzed, time has passed and you don't want to delay getting started with their treatment. So often we don't have that data until the surgical material is available, and then we typically, for all of our patients who undergo a resection for their lung cancer, we do reflex automatic testing for EGFR, KRAS, and ERCC1, all of our resected patients.
Now, in both of these studies, do you continue the biologic, in one case erlotinib and the other bevacizumab, after surgery?
Right. 2 years for the erlotinib and 1 year for the bevacizumab.
And what have you seen on these two trials in terms of both efficacy and side effects?
I think that in general, as far as the Avastin, I think that what we do is we give 4 cycles of the taxotere cisplatin chemotherapy, but we only give 3 cycles of the Avastin, so we omit the Avastin with the 4th cycle, so we leave a reasonable time frame between the last dose of bevacizumab and the time of the operation. And by and large, we've been seeing good results in terms of tumor regression and downstaging of patients, and we've also been able to do these operations safely without excess morbidity from the preoperative Avastin on board. The total trial size is about 70 patients, and we're about 45 patients into it.
And how about post-op? When do you start the Avastin again?
We typically start about 6 to 7 weeks after recovery from the surgery.
What have you seen during that year on bevacizumab in terms of side effects, tolerability, hypertension, etc.?
It's really been very good. There's been very well tolerated. We've had really very manageable hypertension and no other excess side effects, and so in long-term maintenance type approach with the bevacizumab has been tolerated well in these patients.
Now, I know a key issue in this type of work is looking at the tissue. Any sort of unique things that you're looking at in terms of trying to look at correlations between efficacy?
I think that we're starting to broaden our approach in terms of our molecular analysis of tumors samples that we receive in general, and in addition to EGFR and KRAS testing, we've broadened the range to test multiple different genes that may be involved in the tumor pathways. In particular, we've been looking at things like PI3 kinase and RAF kinase, and a whole panel of genes that we've been looking at, about 30 genes, to see where other mutations may be present. And I think it's helping us to characterize patients' tumors better, and also to potentially use that information for a more targeted approach as newer and better targeted therapies come online.
Anything that you've seen looking at bevacizumab, even in other tumors, that looks interesting or exciting in terms of predicting efficacy? There was some work done in breast cancer at Indiana University. It was published in the JCO looking at SNPs and hypertension. I think there's been some stuff in renal cell. What do you think about that work and anything else in terms of trying to predict Bev efficacy?
I think it's hard because so few patients do develop hypertension. I think it's hard to use that surrogate. What we have been doing in this induction trial is we've been giving the bevacizumab alone as the first dose, and then 2 weeks later starting the chemotherapy and then doing a CT scan pre and post 2 weeks of just single agent bevacizumab. I mean, we've seen some very interesting results in terms of tumor regressions, and including some dramatic tumor regressions in patients with just one dose of bevacizumab and scanning them 2 weeks later. So I think that although the thinking is that single agent bevacizumab may not have tumor regression activity, I don't think that's true. And I think that we are seeing a regression of tumors in some patients. And I think it'll be interesting as we go forward in this trial to see if we can correlate our response and pathologic complete response and our survival data to those patients who may have had evidence for regression early on with the bevacizumab.
It's interesting. To what extent has Bev as single agent therapy been looked at in lung cancer?
Almost none. I think just really some of the early phase one trials have had a small number of patients with lung cancer, but I don't think it's been looked at in any single agent phase two trial.
Any dynamic or vascular imaging studies that you're doing also?
It's hard to do that for some of our lung cancer patients. It's hard to do DCMRI in lung because of the motion artifact. So I think it's a challenging technology to use in general. We haven't been doing it in some of our other trials. What we've been doing more and more in our lung cancer trials is doing volumetric imaging and doing three-dimensional tumor measurements, really using an automated algorithm for measuring a tumor through our radiology and medical physics group. And what they've also been able to do is, in addition to size, they've been able to look at tumor density and see how changes in tumor density may correlate with response as well, because certainly we've all seen our patients who may have a tumor cavitate or become more of a ghost, but the actual size hasn't changed, but we can sort of capture density in addition to size.
Now, you mentioned that the chemo backbone for this Bev neoadjuvant study is cis-docetaxel, and you've done work on that. In fact, you've published on that. Can you talk a little bit about that regimen and what we know about it?
Well, I think that the taxotere cisplatin regimen has been extensively studied, and I think one of the positive aspects of that combination is the doses have been fairly uniform in multiple phase three trials, and there hasn't been dose attenuation translating from the trials to clinical practice, and I think that's a positive thing. We've also seen that that backbone has been useful in comparing it in stage four patients to vinorelbine and cisplatin in terms of showing a superiority in survival. So one of the reasons we chose docetaxel and cisplatin as our neoadjuvant approach was we know that vinorelbine and cisplatin is really the most robust data in terms of adjuvant treatment. Really, the three positive trials, by and large, it was a combination of vinorelbine and cisplatin. So if we extrapolate and say that in stage four patients that the docetaxel cisplatin showed some advantage, it makes some sense to try to use that approach in terms of our neoadjuvant treatment.
And when you treat patients in the adjuvant setting off study, is that the regimen you generally use or do you use something else?
It's one of the regimens that we use. I think we still believe in vinorelbine and cisplatin, and I think that that's really where the data is the strongest. So I think we tend to tailor our regimens to our patient, but the docetaxel and cisplatin is one of the regimens that we use.
You mentioned the adjuvant ECOG study that's looking at chemo plus or minus bevacizumab. What are your thoughts about that study?
I think it's an important trial, and I think that it is going to be very interesting to see what impact Avastin has in terms of survival benefit on top of chemotherapy. The chemotherapy regimens are chosen by the investigator, and I think that it's been accruing well, and I think it'll be an interesting study to see the results of.
Any speculations in terms of what you think we might see? I mean, obviously the issue of bevacizumab in the adjuvant setting is being looked at in a lot of solid tumors. Any thoughts about whether or not you think it might work?
It's a large study, and I think it needs to be a large study to show some modest survival benefit. I think that based on what we've seen in the stage four patients, I'm certainly optimistic that it could be a positive trial.
Let's talk about the other neoadjuvant study, the one that involves erlotinib. How do you find it bringing patients out to a year or 2 years on erlotinib? How do people do?
You're right. I think that it's a different scenario for patients who've had resected disease to keep them on a therapy when they don't have any clinical evidence of cancer. And this study was on the heels of a trial that we did that we recently completed for earlier stage patients, primarily stage one patients, who were, again, enriched for having an EGFR mutation, those patients who had a minimal smoking history or were never smokers. And we gave them just single-agent erisegafitinib for 3 weeks and then operated on them. And if they had a mutation or they had a response, which ended up being about half of the patients, they went on to be recommended to receive adjuvant gefitinib. And by and large, gefitinib is a better tolerated agent side effects-wise than erlotinib. And it was certainly challenging to have patients keep on this treatment for a two-year period, especially when they have had stage one lung cancer. There were some patients who didn't want to continue trial due to the diarrhea or the fatigue or other side effects, but most patients were able to see it through. And I think that people understand the importance of being aggressive in the treatment of lung cancer given its prognosis. And I think that our goals at every stage of lung cancer is to try to be as aggressive as possible.
Can you kind of provide an update of where we are in terms of identifying patients with tumors that are enriched for response for the TKI, EGFR TKIs, mutation, FISH, IHC? Where are we today, and what do you think an oncologist and community-based practice needs to know about from that regard? It's kind of interesting that places like yours, you utilize these things every day. And yet, out in practice, a lot of people aren't even aware, or these factors are not necessarily even being utilized.
I think that we utilize them, but I think that we use them to guide us. I think that, first of all, not every patient who we see with lung cancer has enough material for us to do the EGFR mutation testing. And then by the time we get it back, time has passed. And I think that our general approach is we tend to do the EGFR mutation testing on everyone who we can get material on. So we ask patients who come to see us for a new visit to bring unstained slides in addition to stained slides to their visit. And I think that, firstly, of those patients who have advanced stage lung cancer who have a less than 15-pack-year smoking history, I think it makes some sense to give them a short course of erlotinib as their first-line treatment, 3-4 weeks. And if they respond and it's regressing, then fantastic, you can keep going. And if it doesn't, you can move on to more standard treatment approaches. I think that the ways that submitting material for mutation testing is those patients who come into your office who maybe have a 70-pack-year smoking history, or those patients, you know, who you really didn't expect necessarily to have a mutation, but they do. So I think that those patients, it can be very helpful. It can also be helpful to have in terms of seeing that they have a RAS mutation, because those patients don't respond in terms of regression to the Tarceva. So I think that primarily in terms of making our treatment decisions for stage 4 patients when they come into our office, we make them on the clinical characteristics, and that can be done anywhere. And I think that the smoking history above ethnicity or gender or expression or FISH, I think the smoking history is what we use as the most important parameter. These mutation testing results are also not 100% reliable. They require a certain percentage of tumors versus normal cells, and so you can have false negatives. So if somebody comes in, they never smoked, and you come back with a negative test, doesn't necessarily mean that they don't have a mutation-type response.
Can you talk a little bit about what was presented at the ASCO meeting about the relationship to cetuximab in non-small cell cancer? And where do you think things are heading in terms of that agent, in terms of non-protocol usage?
We have begun to use it in our lung cancer patients, and I think that based on the FLEX data, that patients who are receiving first-line therapy, who are not candidates for bevacizumab for a variety of reasons, we're using the cetuximab as part of their first-line therapy.
How do you think the side effects and toxicity are going to play out specifically in this patient population?
I don't treat other tumor types, so using cetuximab has been newer for me than for some other oncologists, and I think that managing the rash and the electrolytes has been a little bit challenging, and I think that these are issues in terms of tolerability, but by and large, we have some experience already with the rash with Tarceva, and so we've been able to make sure to act upon the toxicities early, so to try to prevent them from getting more severe, and I think we've been doing okay.
You said electrolytes?
Like magnesium, hypomagnesemia that they can develop. We don't really know what to do with a low magnesium other than that we get nervous about it and we feel we need to replete them, but I don't know that it has sequelae.
Any other clinical research efforts going on right now, either at Memorial or outside of Memorial, that you think are promising in terms of moving the field forward?
Well, I think that if you look at the mutation story, I think that trying to target EGFR and KRAS mutations in general is very important. And I think that if you look at adenocarcinomas of the lung, so that's not squamous, not small cell, but look at just adenocarcinomas, about 15 to 20% of those patients will have an EGFR mutation, and about 20% will have a KRAS mutation. So if we can develop a targeted approach that's effective for these types of mutations, then I think we're doing some good. So in terms of KRAS, there are a number of different agents and trials which are under investigation to look at targeting KRAS. We talked a little bit about EGFR and target it with Tarceva. I think the second level of challenge is what to do when these patients develop resistance or acquired resistance to the Tarceva, which invariably occurs in everyone on average about a year or so later. So we and others are working on combination approaches or next generation EGFR inhibitors to try to overcome that acquired resistance. And I think that's really the next challenge for these patients with EGFR mutations.
Now, you talked about targeting KRAS, and so far I've gotten to the point of thinking, well, KRAS is downstream of EGFR. I haven't quite got beyond that. I don't know if there's anything you can talk about in terms of qualitatively what's involved with KRAS and what kinds of agents potentially might be able to target it.
Well, I think you're right. I think that probably the answer may need to be targeting multiple tyrosine kinase receptors and sort of taking a more global approach to inhibition. The farnesyl transferase inhibitors 10 years ago, there's a lot of hope for them to be able to inhibit the RAS mutation, but they were not successful. So I think we're still in development, work in progress, really, in terms of finding the best way to inhibit KRAS.
You talked about utilizing histology in making treatment decisions. Can you talk a little bit more about that and the data sets that you're referring to?
There was a trial from ISLAC, from Scott Gliotti, which was published recently, showing that comparison of pemetrexed and cisplatin with gemcitabine and cisplatin showed equivalence in terms of survival. But when the histology was looked at in that trial, the patients who had adenocarcinoma had a better survival with pemetrexed and cisplatin, whereas the patients who had squamous histology had a better survival with gemcitabine and cisplatin. So I think that that's been interesting data showing that the different histologies can respond differently to different chemotherapy agents, where taxanes fit into that mix. It wasn't really addressed in that trial, so I think it complicates things a little bit. But certainly I think it's helpful data to us in terms of trying to tailor our treatment approach based on histology.
You mentioned taxanes. I wanted to ask you about a paper you published this year in the JCO looking at nab-paclitaxel. Obviously, there's been a lot of interest in that in breast cancer. Can you talk about the work that you published and what we know about nab in lung cancer?
Well, I think the nab-paclitaxel, which is albumin-bound paclitaxel and is free of cremophore and ethanol, so there's no vehicle, so there's really no risk of hypersensitivity allergic reactions, was an interesting trial for us to do because it was a frontline trial for patients who had stage 4 disease, and it was a single agent trial. So the inherent bias perhaps for myself as well as my colleagues was to treat patients who are maybe a little bit older, maybe a little bit lower performance status because it was single agent therapy. And I think that it was sort of a reverse bias in terms of the patients that went on. Nevertheless, we found that it was a very active regimen, giving the single agent nab-paclitaxel on a day 1, 8, and 15 every 28-day schedule. And I think aside from the neuropathy, it was well-tolerated, and I think it was a good regimen for patients.
Where do you see things heading with nab and lung cancer?
I think that there is plans underway in terms of a registration trial that they're doing with carboplatin combination, and I think we'll see where that goes.
Any other areas of clinical research in lung cancer that we haven't talked about that you think would be worth talking about?
There are a number of small molecule VEGF inhibitors which are under study, and I think that there are some potential advantages to that in addition to them being orally administered, and I think they're also a work in progress, and I don't think there's a front runner in terms of those that's going to replace Avastin in the near future, but there are other compounds which are under study.